Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. It may be cliche to say that we've never seen anything like the political machinations currently happening on Capitol Hill, but it is also very true that we haven't. Tonight, we talk about what's going on the Hill, and my guest is Maryland U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen. If you have a comment or a question for the senator, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Certainly, you're welcome to tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Senator Van Hollen, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
It's great to be with you this evening.
Let's talk about some current events. The latest machinations, as I just described them today, and there are quite a few today as it relates to the impeachment inquiry on Capitol Hill, is that there are at least four individuals from the Trump administration who have not shown up to testify before the various House committees. For the novice who may understand that once you are subpoenaed to testify, that you are supposed to show up, how is it that folks are not showing? How do they get away with that?
Well, that's a very good question because, as you say, a subpoena is essentially an order to show up, to testify under oath. And there's a process for enforcing subpoenas. The challenge we've got right now is, number one, a White House that is totally stonewalling all these subpoena requests because they clearly don't want their witnesses or White House witnesses to come tell people the truth under oath. And we have a court system that's really not well adapted to trying to turn around these subpoenas quickly. So what happens is when the House of Representatives subpoenas a witness and the witness doesn't show up, they sometimes ask a judge to make the determination, and then you go into this long process. Now, the good news is most of the judges who have looked at these House subpoenas, in fact, to my knowledge, all of them, have said that the witnesses have got to show up. However, those can then be appealed, and the process takes time. So the House Democrats are going to have to make a decision pretty soon. Are they going to wait for all of these witnesses to be, you know, processed by the courts in order to testify, which could take weeks and weeks, or have they concluded that they've got enough evidence right now to move forward on impeachment, and it's not worth just getting more evidence that backs up what you've already got? So that's sort of a practical question that they're going to have to deal with. But I'm as frustrated as anybody watching this process because a subpoena is a lawful order to show up. You can contest it, but courts have got to be more efficient about processing these subpoenas.
The other news today is that an appeals court in New York has essentially said that President Trump must release his tax returns. This has been an issue and then a battle that has been going on since the 2016 election. The next step is the U.S. Supreme Court. What are your thoughts about how this tax fight is going over the president's returns?
Well, there are two issues related to the president's finances. One are the tax returns, and the other relates to all the other financial papers that are relevant, the president's financial papers that are relevant to other cases that are proceeding right now. In my view, the Congress in the investigations it's conducting has made a very good case that they have a justifiable reason for looking at the president's financial data. There's lots of evidence that the president may have engaged in wrongdoing in that area. And so I think the courts are ultimately going to, as the judge started to today, require that that information be turned over to Congress as part of a legitimate inquiry into wrongdoing by the president.
One of the things that's always kind of fascinated me about this whole tax thing is that certainly there's no law that says presidential candidates have to do this. And this is just a practice that has happened since Richard Nixon. The thing that I find really fascinating is that President Trump has not only with taxes but with so many practices done things that have historically never been challenged, and then he has challenged them. In other words, people usually don't do that, and he says, I'm going to do it, and then it seems like people are kind of running around with their hair on fire because no one has ever told us no before. How do you deal with that? And I'm not just speaking necessarily about the courts, but the entire political landscape, when someone's never told you no, and then you tell them no, and then you don't know what to do about that.
Well, you have a president who is flouting all the norms of our democratic system and believes he will get away with it. And, of course, the main way to hold the president accountable ultimately is at the ballot box, where you would hope that Americans would want the president to come clean on these issues, because there's a very simple question here, which is that if you've got nothing to fear and nothing to hide, why don't you give us this information? And yet you have a president time and again sort of, as you say, violating these norms, including the Emoluments Clause, a provision in the Constitution that says that presidents should not be able to profit from foreign governments and foreign contributions, which, of course, he's getting at places like Trump International Hotel right here in Washington, D.C., and other businesses around the world. And what you see is these foreign governments trying to ingratiate themselves with President Trump by staying at Trump hotels. That's the whole reason we have an Emoluments Clause in the Constitution, to prevent foreigners from trying to essentially buy influence in that way, and making sure the president's first priority is the American public, not foreign government. So that's just one example. The other is this president's refusal to really acknowledge and take seriously the overwhelming evidence from his own intelligence agencies about Russian interference in our elections, and his refusal to do anything about it. I have a bipartisan bill with Senator Rubio from Florida that would say to Vladimir Putin right now, if we catch you interfering in an election, there will be automatic, very stiff penalties and sanctions on your banking sector, on your oil sector, because right now Putin can interfere cost-free. Right? He gets to divide America against each other. We have to raise the price. I mean, there has to be a price to pay for foreign governments interfering in our elections. But Trump, he is not supporting this legislation right now, so we're pushing hard. But those are just two examples of where this president is ignoring what you would normally think is sort of bipartisan common sense when it comes to protecting our democracy and making sure that he's not benefiting from foreign governments.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I'm talking to Maryland U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen about politics on the Hill. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. Again, number lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let's go to Dr. Herron, calling from Lanham, my hometown. Dr. Herron, what's on your mind?
Yes, my name is Dr. Marva Herring. I'm a veteran of the United States Army and the United States Air Force, as well as a two-time breast cancer patient and survivor. And I just wanted to call in and thank Senator Chris Van Hollen for all that he has done to help me and other veterans and other cancer patients and other citizens. His office will throw down hard to help veterans. They will go to bat for you and with you, send your paperwork out, even if it's late. and still try to help you. So thank you, sir. I haven't had a chance to say that, so I want to say thank you, sir. And I want other people to know how much he values us to the point where he does it and doesn't say a word about it. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your service to our country. Thank you for those remarks. We take very seriously constituent issues throughout Maryland. And when we've got a veteran who served our country, who's not being properly served by the Veterans Administration or any other government agency, you bet we put up a big fight. And when it comes to health care, we need to make sure that our veterans get the health care they deserve and continue to work to make sure that we provide both the insurance, but also that we have to do that important research, whether it's fighting cancer or other diseases. And I am pleased that we've been able to increase the budgets at the National Institutes of Health so that we can develop more treatments and ultimately cures to cancer and other diseases. But thank you for your service. You know, there's a whole lot of bad stuff happening in Washington, D.C. So what I tell my team is if we can do a good thing for a constituent in Maryland, it does make it all worthwhile, even after a bad day on Capitol Hill.
Dr. Herring, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. I'm talking to Maryland's U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen. James, calling from Waldorf. Thanks for calling, James. What's on your mind?
Yes, I heard the senator's response regarding subpoenas not being adhered to or showing up to speak in front of Congress. And I guess I'm still a little troubled by the response, because I think of scenarios where, let's say, maybe a parent ignores or doesn't appear to court for child support. There seems to be automatic remedies in place for that. There are warrants served to arrest a person, et cetera. Even for certain driving or traffic offenses, if they don't show up for court, there's certain remedies that are in place that seem to be pretty automatic. Why do those remedies not apply to people who don't show up for subpoenas to, for Congress?
Well, good question. I didn't mean to suggest they don't apply. They do apply. What's happened, though, is that those who are being subpoenaed, most of them are then filing motions in court to try to get the courts to excuse them from showing up for a subpoena. And it takes time. It sort of drags out the process through the courts. And in these cases, they're usually making claims, in my view, illegitimate claims, but claims of executive privilege because they may have worked at the White House. So they're essentially going to court and saying, you know, judge, I got the subpoena, but the president tells me I shouldn't show up because of executive privilege, and I want you, judge, to decide whether I have to show up or not. And that just takes time. I do believe the courts will ultimately order the recipients of these subpoenas to show up and testify in Congress. But Congress essentially has to enforce its subpoena authority through the court system. And that's it. So it's not that there's no penalty for people ignoring a subpoena. You can't ignore it. But what they're doing is saying, I have a legal justification for not showing up, judge, and judge, you tell me whether I'm right or wrong.
James, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking to U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland about what's going on Capitol Hill. Before I go back to the phone lines, I wanted to talk about something that you touched on when you were talking about your bipartisan bill with Marco Rubio, Senator Marco Rubio. One of the things also that I find really interesting is the partisan mood on the Hill. Yesterday on Meet the Press, they were spouting statistics as they often do. And one of the things I found really interesting, and you and I are both old enough, at least peripherally, to remember Watergate. Hope I'm not putting your age out there. But
No, you got me.
Yeah, exposed. Got you. Yeah, exposed. Yeah, me too. But, you know, historically speaking, there were Republicans who broke ranks and supported Democrats during the initial impeachment process during that. During the impeachment process for President Clinton, there were Democrats that broke ranks and sided with Republicans as to whether and voted in favor of impeachment for President Clinton. And yet last week with the inquiry vote, with the exception of two Democrats, it was a straight party vote. Democrats saying yes, Republicans saying no. And this obviously, in the House. But that just fascinates me. How do you work with that kind of atmosphere? How do you get stuff done when everything is just so blue and red? Doesn't appear to be any purple on the Hill right now.
Well, it has been very difficult to get things done for the reasons you say. There's so much political polarization. Now, I should say that while the focus of a lot of media attention on the House has been on the impeachment inquiry, at the same time, the reality is the House has passed a lot of very important legislation for the country. They passed legislation to require universal background checks for gun safety. They passed legislation to break down the barriers to voting.
But when it gets to your side, yeah.
So I was going to say those did pass some of the, like the gun safety bill in the House did pass with bipartisan House support, but it gets to the United States Senate. And Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, has said no. He said no to the gun safety bill, no to voting rights bill, no to getting rid of secret money in politics, and the list goes on and on. And so we have come to this point.
Hold that point. Excuse me, okay. Senator. I've sure. got to take a really short break,
but I
then
understand.
I will let you finish.
I understand.
And also, I want to let our listeners know, Deidre calling from Sterling, Virginia, James calling from Laurel, Stewart calling from Gaithersburg. Please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. Do not hang up. You will be able to hear the program. We will continue our conversation with U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen from the great state of Maryland. Coming up on WHUR, Angela Stribling in for Jeff Brown with The Quiet Storm. This conversation will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141 in just a few seconds.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we're talking Capitol Hill politics with U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before the break, we were talking to the senator about getting things done or not on Capitol Hill. Please finish your point, Senator.
Well, so you have this polarization where the Republican leader in the Senate now is saying no, 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 no to all these bills that are coming over from the House, even though they have very broad public support. If you look at any of the polling data, I mean, gun safety having about 90% support among the public. But you have this pattern right now where Republican senators are scared to death about being on the wrong end of a Donald Trump tweet. So probably, from my perspective, the only thing that Donald Trump says that has been true when he tweets is that he has 90% support in the Republican Party. And so that means that Republican House members and Republican senators, who a lot of us would normally count on to do the right thing. You talked about Watergate. Right. You talked about other impeachment proceedings where people would look at the facts. But what they're much more worried about is being on the wrong side of Donald Trump and a Donald Trump tweet, because then when it comes to their Republican primary, then they get in trouble. In fact, we had a Republican House member who maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago said he was going to vote just for the impeachment inquiry, and within 3 days he decided not to run for re-election. Same thing happened to Senator Jeff Flake. So we need people to step up as patriots and stand up for principle. But what we're seeing primarily is just a lot of politics, and it does worry me about our system, because when it comes to the solemn process of impeachment, it is important that people look at the facts. And I know for sure, if you'd seen this fact pattern from President Barack Obama, our Republican colleagues would have launched the impeachment inquiry a very, very long time ago. I salute Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi, for getting the facts and moving forward in a deliberate manner. We're now at a critical mass, and I think she will begin the full public hearings in a few weeks. And impeachment decisions will come by the end of the year.
But, I mean, to be fair, because I know a lot of people always say, well, if this were President Obama, you know, everyone would have been running around with, you know, their hair on fire trying to impeach him even for that beige suit that he wore. But to be fair, the same could have happened with President Bush with the Iraq War situation. And it did not. And, this is a really... It seems that this is just such a unique situation, and I just wonder, even though, now the Democrats have control of the House, but the Republicans are still in charge, you know, of the Senate, you know, from your perspective, how can you get stuff done? And this is to that point, because there's some things that you are trying to get done, particularly like the Handgun Purchaser mm-hmm. Licensing Act. That's, you know, you and Congressman Raskin. But it seems to me that may make perfect sense in the city, but in the rural parts of America, you may get a what? So how do you get stuff like that done?
So there are things that we can get done and we have gotten done, and they don't get much attention. So I'm glad you've asked about them. One involves veterans. So we heard from a veteran who called in. When it comes to providing veterans health care services, we've not only worked on constituent services, but we've worked on bipartisan legislation to make sure that veterans can go to a convenient hospital or a convenient health care provider and get the care that they need. When it comes to fighting the opioid epidemic, Congress has to come together on a bipartisan basis to address that issue in two rounds of major legislation. When it comes to providing resources for important priorities, at least on Capitol Hill, you've seen important alliances between Republicans and Democrats. So investing in medical research at the National Institutes of Health, bipartisan support. Even though the Trump administration proposed budgets, I should say, for very deep cuts to medical research, or very deep cuts to protecting the Chesapeake Bay or cleaning up our rivers, very deep cuts. But despite that, we've been successful working on a bipartisan basis on Capitol Hill to restore those funding and, in fact, build on those funding. We're right now having a big battle over HBCUs and funding historically black colleges and universities. And there's general agreement on Capitol Hill, bipartisan, that we need to move forward. But right now, actually, the House Democrats have passed a really good bill to make sure that we fully fund for the coming year HBCUs. And Mitch McConnell and our colleagues are holding that up. Now, they say they're doing it for procedural reasons. Our view is just bring up the bill and vote on the bill, and let's get it done. So I guess bottom line, there are some areas where we've been able to, you know, get bipartisan consensus. On some foreign policy issues, Republicans really don't like what the president's doing, like when he stabbed our Syrian Kurdish allies in the back. These are the folks who've been working with us on the front lines against ISIS, helped us get Baghdadi. And then, you know, Trump turns around and says, okay, Turkey, President Erdogan, go ahead and kill our Syrian Kurdish allies. So there has been bipartisan resistance to those kind of things. But on some of the big issues that, you know, we're all fighting for, we still see this polarization, which can only be through elections.
Yeah. Let me go back to the phone lines. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Let's talk to James, calling from Laurel. James, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing just fine, thanks.
Senator, Congressman, I work with you up in Montgomery County, and I think you're doing a great job. But my concern is that with the impeachment on the way, and God forbid if this man wins the election again, can charges be brought up against him when he's in office for impeachment again, or when he gets out of office, filed with the felony charges that they're saying that are that he has have done?
There it is, the sitting president question and felonies. And please go right. I'll definitely let you handle that one.
So there are a lot of layers to that. And thank you for your question and your work in Montgomery County. Step one is the current impeachment proceeding. And then if the House impeaches the president, you go to the Senate, of course, for the conviction. And we will have a trial in the Senate. As of right now, and I don't think I'm telling anybody something they don't know. As of right now, it looks like Republican senators are just showing their political allegiance to the president and refusing so far to really step back and look at the facts. So look, number one is in 2020, in my view, everyone's got to work really hard to beat Donald Trump. I mean, that's got to be the top priority. If he was to be defeated and leave office, he is then subject to, prosecution for crimes that he has committed.
But is that really likely? We would be talking about an ex-president of the United States, and we saw what happened with Richard Nixon. He was pardoned by Gerald Ford, and we do have, vice president. If he were to be defeated, that wouldn't be the case. But there's always the specter of a pardon if something like that were to happen.
No, there is a specter of a pardon, and that, of course, it all depends on the political sort of situation environment at the time. You asked earlier about some of the president's financial records and access to those records. I think that if those records showed that the president had committed, financial fraud or something like that, he would be susceptible to prosecution later on. There is this other issue of a Justice Department memo that had a finding that, presidents, could not be prosecuted while in office. However, that has never been tested in the courts. And there are a lot of people, including myself, that question that assessment. Because let's imagine the president did what he said, during his campaign, he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and, he'd still have a lot of support. But apart from whether he'd have support, the question is whether he could be prosecuted. And I think a president could be prosecuted. The challenge is who's going to bring the case.
Yeah.
And it's hard to have the U.S. Justice Department bring the case against a sitting president. But, a state court, a state prosecutor conceivably could in that kind of case. So, look, a good question. Lots of different pieces to this. I think for now we're just very focused on the current charges that have been made in the House with the impeachment. And we will be I expect the Senate will be listening to a trial in January.
I only have a few minutes left, and I did want to ask you about something certainly much more personal, the loss of Elijah Cummings. And your thoughts of not only working with him, but also as a friend, the Baltimore connection and the like. You have a few minutes just to share with us your thoughts about what his passing means for you.
It hurts. It hurts a lot. I've known Elijah for about 20 years. We served together in the Maryland legislature, in the House of Delegates. And he got there before I got there. And I remember arriving in Annapolis and first time I heard Elijah get up and speak, the place was quiet. You could hear a pin drop. And I knew that this was a special person, a special Marylander, a special American. And then the pattern was the same. He'd always be the first on his feet in any debate to fight for social justice, equality, and fairness. And then, of course, he took that fight to the Congress. And even in these last months, when clearly he was hurting, he used every ounce of energy to help stand up for our democracy and fight for our democracy. And that's what he did, whether it was for big issues at the national level or fighting for his beloved city of Baltimore and bringing the city together after the tragic death of Freddie Gray. And he was just somebody who was able to summon, such dignity and such power for the country. And we have lost a real hero of our times. And I do worry, because this is one of those moments in our country where we need Elijah Cummings. And so we're going to have to work hard, each and every one of us, to do our best to try in some measure to live up to his example. But I remember him often talking about his parents.
Mm-hmm.
And he would talk about how, he grew up and faced all sorts of hardships and faced discrimination. But his parents taught him always to, treat others with dignity. They taught him to work really hard. And they taught him to love this country as imperfect as it is. And that if you really love your country, what you do is to work to make it even better. You work to make it better. And that's what he did. I'm going to miss Elijah. We had our Maryland delegation meeting. We meet regularly. Is it just the Maryland delegation? And, you get so busy sometimes. But, my goodness, there was just this big, big hole in our delegation. So, anyway, I talked about Elijah for a long time, but thank you for asking. And we just got to do our best to keep the spirit alive.
Maryland U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen, thank you so much for spending some time with us and talking about some of the issues. I could talk to you for another hour about some of those issues, but I know that we're going to lose you now. But please come back. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We're going to take another break. When we come back, we are going to get some political analysis of Capitol Hill politics with Howard University political science professor Dr. Niambi Carter. We'll talk to her in just a bit. Subpoenas being ignored, Ukraine and everything else, are they getting lost in the sauce? Do they care? Your thoughts about that?
I think people do care. I think they may not know all the ins and outs of the issue, but I do think that they can connect this office to literally showing up in their life in particular kinds of ways. Now, of course, this didn't just start with Donald Trump, right? We've been in extended depression in black communities, right? It's like when the recession, everybody else catches the cold, we get the flu. So black people have had this sort of economic issue for a while, even though, this administration touts low unemployment for black people. I don't know that that's enough, because people see the things that he's done at the border and other places and are very turned off by it. I think people will pay more attention once the public hearings get underway. I think this is very much a sort of inside the Beltway Capitol Hill conversation for a lot of people right now. But I think for black people who have always sort of been attuned in a certain kind of way to the ways in which the winds of change on Capitol Hill affect their communities, this is important. It's just not as important right now. But they'll see the importance once, I think, there's more light shed here in the next few months with this looming inquiry. But people do care, because people know that their votes have been systematically stolen, suppressed, and it's all to advantage the current person in the White House.
So, and with that said, moving from what's happening on Capitol Hill to the presidential election, okay, Beto O'Rourke dropped out. The election as a whole, particularly even the front runners, and I use front runners plural, Biden and Elizabeth Warren. Do you believe that the noise from Capitol Hill has overshadowed and perhaps even weakened the race that the Democrats are trying to conduct to unseat Donald Trump?
No, I get what you're saying, right? Like, they seem to be we're competing for people's attention, and will people be able to focus in both places? And I think we can pound our heads and rub our tummies at the same time. And this is why. Because I think what happens with impeachment ultimately does help the Democrats in this primary race. And I think people who have been sort of vying for and talking about a stronger showing by the Democrats are finally getting that. The other thing we have to remember is these falling out of the races are going to happen. You have this many candidates. Somebody has to fall away. Somebody has to lose. And we will see more of it, right? Swalwell came out of the race around the same time as Beto. We'll see more of these over the month. But this primary race is going to last longer probably than this impeachment inquiry. Right, at least that's what Nancy Pelosi wants, is for this impeachment inquiry to end rather quickly, at least by the new year, so that we can move on. But we'll be in this primary fight until probably the convention in August of next year, and we don't have the first primaries until February. So there's still time for these folks to kind of lay in the cut and do their thing, and still trying to win over voters in South Carolina, in Iowa, and all the early primary states that are coming up. And they'll probably use the impeachment as evidence that they should be selected.
One of the things that I find interesting, and I'm sure you heard about the Buttigieg campaign memo that surfaced last week suggesting that his being gay was a barrier to support for some black voters in South Carolina. Obviously, there are black voters everywhere, not just South Carolina, but that was obviously the focus. Do you think that that is an issue?
I'm sure for some black people it is an issue, but I think there are plenty of issues that folks can have with Pete Buttigieg that have nothing to do with his sexuality. I think that's a lazy response because people want to make it about black homophobia as if blacks have a special homophobic gene that other Americans don't share. That's just not true. There are lots of reasons to believe that a 30-something-year-old small-town mayor is not yet ready for prime time. And I think for black folks who don't know him, who have no reference point for him, in the same way that they understand a Joe Biden who has name recognition, or Bernie Sanders who at least has done this one more time, or Kamala Harris or Cory Booker who might feel a little bit more present for them, Pete Buttigieg just doesn't register. So I think if you want to make sure you actually don't convince black voters, call them names like homophobic, and then you are almost assured to turn those people away. But I think he is just not penetrating with black voters because I just don't think for many black voters, particularly older black voters, he just has no appeal. He's too young. He doesn't look ready. He's held no major national office. He's held no major statewide office in Indiana. So he's not been a governor. He's been a mayor of South Bend, which is a lovely town. But is that preparing you to be the president of the United States? And I think most black people would say no. I think most people would say not yet. He's not ready yet. He needs a few more years.
But you know, the argument, that same argument, with the exception of the age, could be said for the current president. Because
he wasn't going for black voters. Right?
Well, that's true, and I'm just talking about for people who may say that black or white, you know, red or brown or what have you, that, you know, a lot of people could say he's a businessman, but he's never been elected to office. He's never held anything. He's old enough by the standards that are often set by our federal elected officials. But Pete Buttigieg has more governing experience than Donald Trump.
He absolutely does. But the other thing is, one, they're going after different voters.
Yeah.
But two, what Donald Trump did tell people was that I know how to run businesses. I'm a multimillionaire. And if you let me run this country, I will make this country prosperous. And I think for many people, they were also probably thinking that they might become prosperous too. The other thing that Donald Trump did was capture that reactionary vote to 8 years of Barack Obama. And one of the things that predicted selection of Donald Trump was for your president was whether you believed Barack Obama was a Muslim. So as much as it was about Donald Trump, it was also about Barack Obama. So I absolutely think you're right. Donald Trump was unqualified, but Donald Trump was able to gather that cultural moment, right, that sort of reaction, and tell these people who felt left out in the cold, since we said, you know what, this kind of old school racism is not cool, and, you know, made some people feel bad because they thought they lost a little power. He was able to figure out how to harness that energy and bring these people in who had been left out in the cold and told that the way they viewed the world wasn't right, and told them, I'm your guy. I'm not politically correct. I say whatever I want, and I do what I want. Right. And he was able to capture that and win those voters. But let's be clear, he lost the popular vote. And I think we cannot say that enough.
Yeah.
He beat them in the Electoral College, not popular vote. It wasn't even close in terms of the popular vote. So the energy for Donald Trump is not there in all circles.
Indeed. Dr. Nyambi Carter, Howard University political science professor, always fascinating to talk to you. And again, I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Harold. Have a good day.
You too. That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141 for this Monday, November 4th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.